The Fan on Demand. Number one in your programs, number one in your hearts, number one in every friggin' category that matters. Primetime Sports with Bob McCowan on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Hour number two for this Thursday, the 24th of April, 2014. It's Primetime Sports on the Sportsnet Radio and Television Networks. If you're just joining us, hello. I'm Bob McCowan. That's the coach, Butch Carter. John Angelos, the Executive Vice President of the Baltimore Orioles, will join us in studio in a few minutes. Of course, the Orioles in town to play against the Blue Jays and conclude their series tonight. Tim Bontemps of the New York Post will be with us. We'll get the Brooklyn perspective on the Raptors-Nets series. Glenn Healy from Hockey Night in Canada in the next hour, along with Bob Elliott of the Toronto Sun on some more baseball stuff. What'd you watch last night, Coach? You watch the Blue Jays play at all?
I was so upset. 6-1, I'm thinking, you know, okay, I can flip
cruise over, control, yeah.
You know, and watch a little basketball in Houston and amazed at what didn't happen there, but... It happens.
It happens. There's nothing more frustrating as a fan than to have that happen because you're counting your chickens, right? And you should never do that in any sport.
Right.
A 6-1 lead in the second or third inning is, you know, lots of time left. And while McGowan has had he's had one really good outing. He's had a few shaky ones. And they marched all the way back, and the Blue Jays couldn't do the same.
I just get concerned because historically, one of the strengths is supposed to be the bullpen.
And then
what happened in Cleveland, and then here, and you want to root for the home team. So they got us off to a great start, and then it became very depressing.
Yeah, and it's only one game out of 162, to put it in context, but nonetheless. We'll talk more about it with Mr. Angelos when he wanders in here. So what did you see on the basketball side last night?
The basketball side, I seen the second coming of Hakeem Olajuwon, the first 8 minutes of the first quarter in Houston. Dwight Howard put on just an unbelievable display for 6 or 7 possessions. I mean, just like, he's going to really dominate the whole game.
Mm-hmm.
And then the rest of his teammates decided to let him play later. And it was really, when you talk about having a start of a game, you're thinking maybe a 40 or 50 point night.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Because when you're scoring and the guy defending you is not in the picture frame, I mean, you've put a mojo on him. And, you know, living in Orlando, and watching Dwight as a young player, he started the game as well as I've ever seen him start any game. And it faded to black.
Who is he, though? We thought he was the next dominant player in the National Basketball Association, a physical presence unlike any other, a guy who was going to be able to dominate games differently than a Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, but with the same kind of impact, like Shaq. You know, there's another guy. He was going to be one of those guys. And there have been periods during his career where he has been that guy. But it hasn't been sustainable. It certainly wasn't that way at the end in Orlando, maybe because he didn't want to be that guy. That never materialized with the Lakers. And intermittently, he's been that guy since he's gone to Houston. But, so what is he now?
Okay, your benchmarks at center, if you want to start with Russell with the rings.
Sure.
All right. Chamberlain talent. Kareem, absolutely poetic, but also a champion. 3 times in college, 6 times as a pro.
Mm-hmm.
And the latest is Shaquille. Dwight is not as good as any of those guys. He's the best center in pro basketball, but he is not as good as those prior.
Did you think he could be that good?
No, because he's not as tall. He's not as strong.
Well, he's pretty strong.
But he's not as strong as Shaquille. He's not as strong as Wilt, all right? But he is. He's unlucky. He gets a style of play in Orlando that I thought damaged him. Because instead,
explain.
Okay, Orlando went with a small point guard. That's a completely different philosophy than when they had Shaquille. Shaquille went with, they went with a tall perimeter players. They rebounded the basketball. The ball did not have to be outletted to one player. It could go to three players. And they'd bounce the ball down the side of the court, and Shaquille would run a straight line down the middle of the court, plant himself under the rim, and the league gave him 6 seconds to get out of the lane.
Yeah.
All right? So that's very important, Bob, because if half the shots are missed in a game, that means your great Hall of Fame player has 50 plays that he can run and trap you under the basket. All right? Mm. So now the other guys can get the other 50 possessions. All right? So it feeds the ego of the guy who's the most important player. Well, Dwight gets caught in a system where they draft a little point guard, Demir Nelson, all right? And they say when the rebound comes off, it has to go to him. So now Dwight can't sprint down the middle of the floor as a young, athletic, big, plant himself in the lane. He's got to go in the lane, wait for Demir to dribble the basketball up, and then come out of the lane and reset against set defense. So philosophically, I think they made a huge mistake in Orlando on what type of offense and what type of system for Dwight.
If they'd had a Penny Hardaway then.
It was because Penny would always pitch the ball ahead. He was not consumed with how many assists do I have.
Mm-hmm.
All right, he'd always pitch it ahead, and they always pitched ahead, and the big fella, Shaquille O'Neal, was planted in the lane, and if you overplayed him in the lane, then he went spin lob on you.
Yeah.
So, you know.
But what if Dwight had had Penny, and Penny had played the way he was capable of playing early in his career?
And then
Totally different?
He'd still be in Orlando. Both of them would still be in Orlando.
Right.
Right? Because, and then he goes west. And instead of staying east, where you don't have to run into all those good teams, he goes west. I believe he was totally injured in L.A. If you look at his, you know, what he did with the Lakers, I think he still led the league in rebounding for centers. All right? And then what he's doing this year, he was injured because he is back to being his athletic self. Mm-hmm. But he's made the mistake of, you know, I'm a king, but I'm going to go in the land of the kings. And he should have stayed east. He could have picked any team in the east in the top. And he probably
been dominant.
They would have been the number one seed playing an eight. Instead, he's a four playing a five, and the five happens to be the Portland Trailblazers.
Yeah, who have proven themselves to be more than capable.
They got one guy that at the right time of the season, the playoff, is on fire. Because if you're averaging 40 points in the playoffs.
Well, that's stupid, huh?
I mean, the rim looks like that big to you.
Yeah. Well, interesting. Who do you see as the best team in the National Basketball Association? Ooh. Is it San Antonio? Do they wear the crown until you give it up?
No, because they don't actually have the crown. They lost the crown.
Well, no, but I mean, you know what I mean. Yeah, like they're going to be there.
I think they have a tough time getting through the Dallas series.
Really? Yeah.
Yeah, because they're you have two dinosaurs. You got Dirk from Dallas and Tim, and both of them could be prone to being injured at any time. And it's hard to win with older guys. Many a franchise has been frustrated that they held on to their older player for the right reasons, out of loyalty. But when it got to the semifinals or the finals of the conference, that they weren't able to come through.
So if it's not San Antonio, is it Oak City? Or is it somebody else?
It's Oklahoma City should be the team that comes out of the West. Their toughest test is probably this first one with Memphis. 2 years ago, Memphis knocked San Antonio out because
this is just a matchup thing.
It's just a matchup thing. It's just, you know, the worst matchup to get matched up with is Memphis. No, nobody wanted to play Memphis. And if you think about it, since Gasol, young Gasol came back, Memphis has the best record in the West.
Well, and also we should point out that those of us who follow the East and follow the Raptors, Memphis, the eighth seed, I think won 48 or 49 games, either the same as the Raptors or one more than the Raptors. I can't remember which.
Correct. I think if you looked at the record at the end of the year, if you put anyone, everyone in the NBA in one line and said on one loss record, the Raps would have been 10th or 11th.
Yeah. 8, 9, 10, 11.
Right.
Because they would have been behind all eight teams in the West.
Correct.
Plus Indiana and Boston.
Correct. So, I mean, that's the true benchmark. But historically, your record against the opposite conference has not been relevant to what happens in the NBA Finals. So you might have had a great – this year they talk about the Raps won so many games against Western Conference teams. They actually said they set a new record. But I think they need to check whoever's doing the stats because all they did was tie the record of my 2000 team where we had 16 wins against the West.
Wow.
So it's not, you know, you do what you do. The problem with this franchise for all the coaches who have been there is not really what they do on the road. We've not yet shown that dominance that you need to show by winning 35 games at home in a 41-game season.
We talk a lot about the cycle of power in the National Hockey League. It's in the West right now.
Yeah.
In the NBA, it's been in the West for an awful long period of time. Are we past the point of this being a cycle in the NBA and there's something else going on here?
No, I think you have, in the East, there's a window of opportunity that if you could establish a defensive-minded, young, athletic team, you're going to be in a pretty good position to have home court advantage for probably a 4 or 5, 6 year period.
Yeah, but it's the Alphonse and Gaston division, though. You know, you take it, I don't want it.
Well,
you know, I mean, Indiana came has built themselves a nice team. I don't know how good they are. They still got to prove it to me. I'm from Missouri when it comes to that. We all know Miami's a world class team, and every bit as good as the top teams in the West. But after that, you know, it's a bunch of guys named who, with due respect at this point. And how long are we going to go with the West being that dominant?
The West will be dominant. As, when you have one of your best players in the league at the center position go from East to West, and players wanting, see, the other thing you remember, the West population-wise has grown so much. You've got more universities in the West playing Division I basketball that those guys want to stay West.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
If you
took the All-Star team, most of those guys played West, except for your point guard, Paul, at Wake Forest. But most of them played West, and they want to stay West. And
yeah. It's interesting because it used to be the other way around because the guys come out of high school don't want to play in the West because they don't get on TV.
That's correct.
So, you know, they get the late game, and they don't get watched that much.
Yeah, so now they have better accountants to tell them which are the tax-free states.
Yeah, I guess.
But the West produces a lot better a group of players than it used to, and those guys prefer to play out West.
Do you believe there's a philosophical difference in the way teams in the West put a team together as opposed to the teams in the East?
Yeah, the West has always been more run and gun. You know, if you go from Showtime Lakers before them, you know, bringing the ABA
Denver,
teams. You
Denver know, used to score like 140 a night.
Denver, San Antonio. And then you look at, you know, what they have with Houston and OKC. They both want to say, you know, we'll outscore you. And so the problem they run into, like Houston with Portland, is that pace in a basketball game requires the cooperation of the opposing team. You need them to shoot the basketball early in the shot clock, and you need them to miss shots.
Yeah.
Then you can run. Well, Portland is passing the ball 3 or 4 times, and then someone is making a very good shot, and Houston is having to walk the basketball up the court. And so as the game moves along, for the first time, James Harden isn't playing Superman, and the team is getting, their sphincter is tightening up, all right? A noose is being put around their neck, and they feel it for the first time.
So is it easier? We want to move on, but we want to get to our guests, but is it easier, in your opinion, for a slowdown walk the ball up team to slow the game down against a run and gun team, or is it easier for that run and gun team to change the pace and make it more frenetic.
Whichever team has more physical ability will help their style of play. So Memphis is a slow but physical team, all right? So it helps their style of play. And in their mind, they know, all right, we were not racehorses. We weren't born racehorses. We were born Clydesdales, so let's be Clydesdales.
Right.
All right? So it's a matter of, you know, mental toughness and physicality. And Memphis is a perfect example of that. And if you look at historically, the Denver teams, George Karl, you know, great pace during the year, get wiped out during the playoffs.
A little bit later on, Tim Bontemps of the New York Post will join us. Also, Glenn Healy from Hockey Night in Canada, Bob Elliott of the Toronto Sun. We're pleased to be joined in studio by the Executive Vice President of the Baltimore Orioles. John Angelos is with us. John, good to meet you. How are you?
Great. I'm great. Great to meet you guys.
I assume this is not your first trip up to Toronto.
It is not. I love Toronto. Been coming for many years.
Do you try and get on the road as often as you can with the team? How many games would you go out for?
I'd go out for 81 away games if I could. unfortunately, I haven't been able to justify that. But, you know, spring training, client trips, things like that, New York, Toronto, all the fun cities. But it can never be enough. Baseball's great, home and away.
Give us your general thoughts on your team this year and going into this year and where you sit right now. You pretty comfortable with what you got?
We're giving away a T-shirt in a couple days in Baltimore at Camden Yards, and it says, Buck likes our guys. So if Buck Showalter likes our guys, that's the only opinion that counts. But we you know, Buck and Dan Duquette have done a great job with our team the last 3 years. They're really the architects of it. You know, when you're in ownership, when you're in the business side, your role is to give those guys the resources they need and rely on their opinions and try and build a franchise that way. And those guys have built the old-fashioned way, the old Oriole ways of the Earl Weaver Oriole tradition, you know, build pitching and defense and scouting and player development, which is, you know, the place you probably don't want to be from a baseball side and from a business side is you don't want to be in a place where you're building around position players and a lot of free agency. And you're not focusing on your scouting and player development because that's how you get in trouble.
But you did make some moves in terms of free agency. You have, you know, spent the money, taken the risk, if you will, of free agency. So, in essence, I guess what you're saying is we will do the free agent thing as a small piece of the puzzle, but you can't build the base through just spending money.
You can't and you cannot. I think unless you're one of those few one, two, or three clubs in certain markets that are way out on the stratosphere and they can sort of play with funny money, I think you can then sort of make up for a multitude of sins by just buying players here and there and everywhere. But for most clubs, 26 clubs, 25 clubs, that's not the way to do it. You got to build with scouting and player development.
Just out of interest, what's the approximate payroll of the Orioles this year?
We'll probably be, you'll see different numbers in the media because people include different things.
Sure.
But in terms of just salary, we'll probably be in $95-$100 million plus benefits and other things that go into it. But that's sort of the base salary number.
And ownership is comfortable with that number? You think that's the number you sort of have to be at?
Obviously, as you start to build some momentum and fans start to come in the door and so forth, you can start to move
ramp that
number
up.
Yeah, I mean, we don't go into it with any arbitrary number, as you say. You know, this year we stepped up and I actually met with a group of people and gave a little speech and somebody said to me, well, you know, there's a lot of talk in the media about how you guys sometimes miss out on free agency and don't sign players. And I said, well, you know, we're building scouting and player development. We're going to keep signing guys. We signed Nick Markakis. We signed Adam Jones. We signed Brian Roberts. We most recently Adam Jones to a significant contract for
core guys
for a great player.
Yeah.
And I said, but we're not done. And then shortly after that, we signed, you know, Ubaldo Jimenez. So that was, but we hadn't done that in a while. And I think because it was too soon for us. We hadn't built that foundation.
Yeah. Butch.
Yeah. What was the process when you decided on Buck? Because his reputation is as he's an extreme preparation guy, extremely organized, intelligent about the game in all phases, understands the depth from, I believe, not only his roster, but back through some of his minor league prospects. Can you just walk us through, you know, what you guys were thinking when the job was open?
You know, I think the process, we've had a couple managers, and we've on the team, our ownership group, which is made up of a variety of people, including the Barry Levinson, the director, Pam Shriver, the tennis player, Tom Clancy, who unfortunately recently passed away, the famous author, and others. Jim McKay from the Wide World of Sports is part of our group. And so we tried to take an old school approach. That is, you know, let's make sure that we really have people as your GM and as your manager who kind of remember how they got there. And I think Buck, maybe more than anybody I've ever met in my 20 years being having the good fortune to be exposed to professional sports, really, I mean, he really is like your favorite high school basketball coach or high school baseball coach, like the guy that's the AAU coach that all the kids love. He has a tremendous ability to find not only talent, but to create chemistry and to pick guys for chemistry. And then, you know, Brady Anderson, who was a great Oriole player for me, one of the better leadoff hitters in the history of baseball, is now one of our coaches and one of our VPs in our front office. Brady made the comment that in his 20 years of playing pro ball, and including going back to when he played college ball at UC Irvine, et cetera, he'd never been around a team that had as good chemistry as this club does. Now, that's a tribute to the guys, you know, that they're, it's not the old Red Sox line about 25 guys and 25 cabs, you know, you know, they're the opposite. They like each other. They hang together. They're sort of a clean living kind of group and, you know, not out sort of, you know, burning the midnight oil, which is always good. But I think Buck, and that's a tribute to Buck and Dan for selecting for guys like that and trying to make sure that guys fit together as a unit and aren't just names you hang on a marquee and say, look, we're going to play well. Because that gets you to spring training, and that's about as far. Then you start playing the games. So,
why do you think Buck was out of baseball for as long as he was?
Oh, you know, it's funny. You hear a million stories about guys, both players and coaches, and you know, there's so many guys that give him thumbs up and thumbs down. And the thing I've heard, you know, I had heard about Buck was he's so great at putting a team together. He's sort of, in Buck, he sort of have a manager and a GM all in one. Mm-hmm. He can sort of do all of that. I think that's one of the things Dan likes about him. I mean, you know, I think some of the comments about Buck, which I've never found to be true, was he sort of wears out his welcome or something like that. That's the craziest thing I've ever heard. He's such a level-headed guy and such a guy that really cares about the players and really lives every pitch and is in there really working hard at it, you know, morning, noon, and night. He's more like those stories I've heard about football coaches that just live the video and are in there obsessing over every second of play and of the game plan. He's that kind of guy. So, you know, I would imagine Buck's going to be with us for as long as he'd like to be.
But isn't there a need for the GM and the coach? It's best when they're all clicking, same mentality. You know, when one's not covering the other one's got him covered. And I think that, you know, I hear that in your voice. That's what you feel you have with these two.
There's a huge energy the last 3 years that we never had. I would say we never had. Obviously, we were successful in the late 90s, and we won some games, and we had high payrolls then, relatively speaking. Mm-hmm. You know, 97, the Orioles led the league in payroll at like $61 million, which is sort of hard to believe when you look back on it. And I think every year after that, the Yankees, you know, blew everybody away pretty much, with maybe a few exceptions here and there. So, you know, I think the Buck, you know, we haven't had that kind of feel around the clubhouse. We've totally revamped our strength. And it's not just one thing, you know, Dan Duquette, you got to sign on and say, what are we going to do with all through the system?
Right.
Nutrition, strength and conditioning, off season conditioning, not having guys show up at spring training, 20 pounds overweight, and then work it off. You know, that's, you come out of the gate badly, you usually don't finish well. So that I think Buck and Dan have done a good job with that.
With John Angelos, the executive vice president of the Baltimore Orioles. This is an interesting division. I don't need to tell you that. with the Yankees spending close to $200 million, the Red Sox not far behind. The Blue Jays have upped their ante. They're pretty close to 150. You mentioned you were, you know, just under 100. Mm. And then there's Tampa. And yet nobody overlooks Tampa anymore because they just keep churning out quality young players and good baseball teams year after year. And every once in a while, the fans here will become chagrined with the fate of this organization, because how can we compete with the dollars and cents of the Yankees and the Red Sox, who don't have to retool or rebuild. All they have to do is retool. All they have to do is throw some money at it, and whatever hole is created, however it's created, they can plug it. Does that same kind of conversation take place in Baltimore? Like, we're in this division. Boy, this is unfair.
Yes, of course it does. It takes place in San Diego, Pittsburgh, Milwaukee, all sorts of markets. Absolutely. And I think the commissioner and the owners and the union have done a lot of good things to try and move the league towards greater and greater parity and competitive balance. But to say that Major League Baseball is where, as just to use one league as an example, where the NFL is in terms of competitive balance would not be an accurate statement. One of the elegant things that the NFL does is create some tremendous competitive balance. They've got a lot of mechanisms and they work really well. So if you want to have 32 teams in all those markets, and you want to include markets like Green Bay, mm-hmm. Jacksonville, and other more, Indianapolis. Right. And, you know, it's interesting. Look at Indianapolis, not the biggest market in the world. They're going to play, what, a quarter century about? They're going to have two quarterbacks.
Right.
Under a different system.
Interesting. Yeah.
Under a different system, a less good system than the NFL has. They've got a great system. Peyton Manning would have played for the New York Giants probably by the fifth or sixth or seventh year he played in the league. And Andrew Luck, probably the same thing. So what a great benefit that the fans in Indianapolis, as a relatively small market, can watch these great quarterbacks and keep them on the team and not just see them float away to a bigger market.
So what's the economic answer for baseball then? If it's not a salary cap per se, and when I say salary cap, I understand there are some restrictions that exist in baseball, but not the same way you see in the National Hockey League, the NBA, the NFL. If not that, then how do you get closer to that at least perceived parity?
Can I add this also in conjunction with the Players Association? Because baseball probably has the strongest Players Association of any.
Well, it has the longest labor piece, too, of professional sport.
Right, ironically, right? Because
it is an irony.
Yeah. How do you solve that problem? I think you have to start thinking about it in terms of not just players and not just owners. And even not just agents, elite agents, because everybody's got their take on it. I think if you start thinking about it in terms of the fans, you start thinking about what's it like to be a fan in Kansas City. Let me ask you this. Is it easier to be a fan of the Chiefs or the Royals? And then you have to say, we want it to be the case that it's as easy or easier to be a fan of the Royals as it is to be a fan of the Chiefs, and to feel like your team has a chance. Just as good a chance as the team in New York or L.A. or Chicago or what have you. I mean, that's the goal. So if you think about it in terms of the fans or the taxpayers that finance stadiums, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, every taxpayer dollar should be equal, right? I mean, if you put a dollar in Toronto, it should be equal to a dollar in New York or a dollar in Pittsburgh or Baltimore or San Diego. So I think if you start thinking about it that way, how do you make it so that every fan is created equal and every taxpayer-supported, subsidized facility is created equal, then you start to move yourself towards rules that make a lot of sense. The NFL, I think, has done it for a variety of reasons, but I think they think it makes it the best game it can be.
Well, but so let me throw something at you that I've thought a lot about, and that is, we understand that the NFL has certain inherent rules and regulations, that it has a salary cap, but what it also has is a flex schedule. They attempt to balance the schedule on an annual basis based upon the performance of the team the year before. It's not always successful. There are always going to be some inequities. You still have to play X number of games against teams in your own division, your own conference. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, there is an effort to take the schedule each year as an isolated year and say, okay, this team is a below 500 team. We're going to try and give them some games against teams that are their equal. Mm-hmm. We all know in the American League East, you got 19 games against the Yankees, the Red Sox, the Rays, and the Blue Jays. Mm-hmm. 76 games, mm-hmm. Almost half your season is just clubbing each other. What if there was more of a flex in that schedule? You don't have to deal with economics. All you have to deal with is results and record.
That's definitely one mechanism you can use.
Is it being talked about at all?
Yeah, sure. They talked about going back to a balanced schedule and versus this unbalanced schedule.
Right.
You know, there's, like all things in life, there's a give and take there. I mean, I will tell you, you know, especially in the last three years or so, we've held our own with the Yankees and Red Sox.
Gotcha.
Prior to that, we weren't holding our own. But one of the benefits that we had was we had a lot of fans coming to Camden Yards.
Correct.
Part of that's because Camden Yards has a great brand and people know it. It wasn't just because fans travel with the team fans of the Red Sox and Yankees. But we get those fans. So you got to take the good with the bad. The question is, how do you create a league so that Red Sox fans want to come to Camden Yards, Orioles fans want to go to Fenway Park? So you've got this commerce, this economic activity, this vibe, this energy about the game, which is what you want.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't have it such that whoever has the larger Nielsen market has the larger payroll and then wins more games. Now other mechanisms, and the commissioner's done a great job. I mean, the other thing, the NFL has more playoff spots.
Correct.
And the NFL has a reverse order draft that is a college draft, so it's an impactful draft.
Right.
They don't draft guys and have them around for five to 7 years. They bring them to training camp. They make it. They cut it. Right. The only interim step might be a taxi squad berth or something like that. So that gives football a big advantage, too. And there's not a lot that anybody can do about that. The question, though, really is, well, can the commissioner, with all the good things he's done to create parity, can he do more? Is there more that can responsibly be done? And you know, when you have these huge payroll disparities, I think the fans ask about that. They ask us about it. Well, what the questions we're talking about here.
Yeah.
Fans ask that. Well, you know, I'm a fan of the Pirates, you know, and now they've done well. But people wonder how long will they have their players, and if they re-sign them McCutcheon, that's great. But will eventually the rubber hit the road and they not be able to sign the other guys?
It was like Tampa. They can pick and choose the odd guy that they can keep, but then they've got to intelligently look at the guys that they would like to keep, but financially cannot, and have to try and turn them in to future players. And they have a tremendous success in doing that. But it's pretty hard, to be a Rays fan and watch this constant, even though your team is competitive, constant turnover, familiar faces. You know a lot of them aren't going to be there for their entire careers. It's just an inevitability. It's the only way for them to do business.
Right, and I think there are many unfortunate sides to that. One of them that doesn't get talked about a lot is sometimes it will be said, well, look at Tampa Bay. They achieved notwithstanding all the hurdles that were in their path. I sometimes look at that the other way. I say, wouldn't it have been interesting? Interesting is probably a soft word for it. Wouldn't it have been exciting for the fans of Tampa and maybe for baseball fields and fans in general to see how many games the Rays could have buried the division by in some of those years when they did win the division miraculously, had there been an even playing field.
Right.
If they had the same payroll, just leave the Orioles and the Jays out of it since we're biased probably room. Let's just take the Rays, the Yankees, and the Red Sox. In those years when the Rays did win a division by however many games, I don't remember how, let's say it was five, I don't know what it was.
Okay.
With even payrolls, there's an argument, there's a scenario where they just run away from the Red Sox and Yankees and beat them by 10, 15 games. Who knows? But you'll never know that until you have more of an even playing field. Now, that all said, baseball's selling 75 million tickets a year, which is a lot of games, but a lot of people coming and sitting in seats. And that's, you know, more than the other three sports combined by far. So there's nothing wrong with the game. The game's doing great.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, what would that do to attendance in a Tampa or a Kansas City or a Baltimore, a Pittsburgh, or here? Would it improve it? Sure. Would the Yankees and Red Sox maybe not sell as many tickets? Maybe. Maybe not. Maybe that wouldn't be the worst thing if you went from 75 million to 80, 85 million, because some of these other markets could do as well, and fans were more bullish.
I kind of agree with him. The issue is you got tradition, and the big markets have not consented to helping the smaller markets as much as they should, because the salary cap, and I'll just speak from the NBA side, when we started in 83, I think it was $3.6 million. And the salary cap, I think, is going to be $83 million this year. And there's a lot of parity, and it weeds out a lot of unethical contracts. There are guys that the NBA learned, you can't give a guy a seven-year contract, an eight-year contract, right? The largest extension, I think, this year is 5 years.
Five.
Right? So clearly.
And baseball is still going the other way. We're still seeing, you know, essentially lifetime contracts being given out.
Baseball has more expense on the development side. They don't have, mature college players. All of them go through the system. Historically, you know, the ethnics have been very successful in coming into baseball and doing very well. And but they have a huge expense, a lot larger expense from providing inventory of young players than football or basketball.
It's a fascinating conversation. I wish we had more time to delve into it because there's all kinds of paths that we could go down, but we're pretty much out of time, and you got things to do too. It's great to meet you. Thank you very much for stopping by.
Thanks for having me, and
you're always welcome here. And when you're in Toronto, you and the O's are in.
Well, with that unbalanced schedule, we're going to make three trips to play all those games. So we'll be back, and look, great history and tradition here. I saw a Molitor Carter T-shirt in a gift shop today. So that was pretty cool.
The good old days.
Yeah.
The executive vice president of the Baltimore Orioles, John Angelos. We'll take the break. Primetime continues on the Sportsnet radio and television networks.
Like free sports tickets, trips, and memorabilia so you can trick your friends, colleagues, and mistresses into thinking that you're some sort of high roller? Hey, join the club.
Welcome to the club.
The fan club. Log on to sportsnet590.ca. Now, more of Bob McCowan and Primetime Sports on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Coming up to 16 before the hour, Primetime continues on the Sportsnet radio and television networks. Bob McCowan, the coach, Butch Carter. Glenn Healy of Hockey Night in Canada, Bob Elliott of the Toronto Sun coming up. So hockey and baseball talk in the next hour. We've gone through the first two games of the Nets-Raptors series, and still out there. And it will, I think, hover over this series probably for its duration, is Masai Ujiri's F Brooklyn. How is it playing in New York, in Brooklyn specifically? Tim Bontemps of the New York Post joins us to talk about it. Hey, Tim, how you doing?
Doing good, guys. How are you?
We're excellent. So this was sort of usually an exclamation point goes at the end of a sentence. Masai decided to put it at the beginning of the sentence. How is this thing? How did it play initially in Brooklyn, and is it playing any differently here after two games?
I don't think it's really changed. I mean, I think most people thought it was kind of amusing and a little surprising, and that's really the end of it. I mean, the media's kind of run with it, and the Nets have had a little fun with it, as you would probably expect. But, I mean, at the end of the day, I don't think it's really going to have a huge impact on the way anybody views any of these games or make anybody care more about, you know, beating Toronto or anything. It is the playoffs after all. So I think, you know, any fans or players or, you know, they were already focused on winning anyway, so I don't think it's going to, you know, change the way anybody really looks at things.
Nets coach, Nets players have handled it with great diplomacy, almost kid gloves, you should pardon the expression. That too, not surprising, I suppose. You know, the best way to respond, I guess, is either do it on the court or not really respond verbally at all.
I think the fact that Masai has apologized several times for it, I think, kind of takes a lot of the sting out of it anyway.
And, right.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't, you know, getting in the back and forth with the GM when, you know, I think it seemed like a pretty calculated move on his part, probably, at least in some respect, to take some of the pressure off of a pretty young roster he has that doesn't have much playoff experience. So, you know, not trying to keep it from becoming even a bigger story than it understandably did is probably the right way to go, I would think.
Coach?
Tim, how's it going to set up? It is Brooklyn's first playoff game in Brooklyn.
That's actually not true. They were in the playoffs last year.
Okay.
Against the Bulls, but.
All right. Thank you for that correction. But how's it going to set up with them, with the Raps coming in? Well, most people think that Brooklyn played their way down to six so they could play three. So, you know, what will the atmosphere be with this young team coming in there?
Well, I think the atmosphere isn't going to change much. I mean, you know, the fans, you know, the Nets and Raptors have been, they've been in competitive games all season. I mean, Toronto's got, in my opinion, one of the best young rosters in the league. They remind me a lot of the Pacers 2 or 3 years ago when, you know, they kind of had a good core group that they could build around and keep together for a long time and kind of develop into a real title contender. So, you know, and in the four games this year, the two teams have split them. Three of them were decided by a combined 7 points. The first two games of this series were combined by a total of 2 points. They were decided by, you know, the Nets outscoring by 2 points. So, you know, the games have been close and exciting. The two games in Brooklyn were both, you know, great games going right down to the end. The crowd is into it. And, you know, I don't really see any reason for that to change. I think it's been a really fun first couple games of the series, and I would be really surprised if that didn't continue for however many games left that it goes.
So I'm guessing that there's nothing you've seen in games one and two that have been totally surprising. This is pretty much what we should have expected.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you knew that the Raptors are going to have a big advantage on the boards. Valanciunas has been fantastic, and you know, they've really maximized their strengths there. You knew that the Nets were going to force a lot of turnovers, or you expected it.
And they have.
And hang on to the ball, and that's happened. You know, I've been a little surprised that the Nets didn't hit more shots, to be honest, if there's any one thing. Toronto left the Nets open for a lot of threes, and a lot of good three-point shooters had wide-open looks that they didn't knock down, which I think if you gave them again, they think they would expect they would hit. And I think Terrence Ross for the Raptors is certainly not played anywhere near the way he would have liked through the first two games, which has surprised me a little bit. But I think it has kind of played out exactly like we thought. It's been two competitive games, and both teams have kind of used their various strengths against each other. And you know, it's got the makings of what everybody thought would be a long and competitive and fun series.
We look for Jason to continue on his strategy of going one-on-one and with DeMar to increase his responsibility defensively, hopefully to tire him on the offensive end. It's pretty much an old school philosophy, you know, find the best offensive player and see if we can stress him on the defensive side and force the staff to make the adjustments. I think that Jason will probably stick with that. But how does that play there in Brooklyn? What the job that Jason's done?
You know, I think early in the year there was a little bit of a question as to how things are going and the Nets were struggling. But, you know, since the start of the new year, they've really turned things around, and he deserves a lot of credit for some of the tweaks they made, putting in Sean Livingston in the starting lineup and moving Paul Pierce to power forward and kind of changing into more of a small ball three-point shooting team as opposed to a, you know, inside-oriented post-up team that they were early in the year. To your point about DeMar, I agree. I don't think that's going to change. You know, the Nets see Joe Johnson as a really big advantage for them in terms of being able to really post up DeMar inside and make him work. And, you know, at the other end, I think they're content to let DeMar shoot these, you know, pretty inefficient, contested 20-foot jumpers. I mean, you know, those shots that DeMar hit at the end of the fourth quarter, they were difficult shots that, you know, more often than not, he isn't going to make. So, you know, if he makes those for the next 4 or 5 games and they win the series on those, I think the Nets will probably just throw up their hands and say, well, you know, he just made the shots that he needed to. But I think they would bet over the course of 7 games that he would have a lot more of those shots not go in. Plus, there's the fact that they had a lot of silly fouls, and they fouled him 3 times on jumpers in the fourth quarter, which, you know, certainly isn't sound defensive strategy either that they think they'll try to fix.
Well, games 1 and 2 have been pretty entertaining. We assume the rest of the series will be the same. Thanks, Tim, for joining us. Tim Bontemps of the New York Post. We'll take the break here. Glenn Healy of Hockey Night in Canada joins us. Bob Elliott of the Toronto Sun, hockey and baseball next hour when Primetime Sports continues coast to coast on the Sportsnet radio and television networks.